Hi, this is Gideon Rothstein. This is a response of the day for the 9th of Iyar. Today I'm going to take a short response of Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank and Shut Har Tzvi in the Evan HaEzer section, responsum 99, which will not take up all of our time, except that I encounter Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank often in my tshuvot. I think he, in my searches, I think he did date many of his tshuvot, but for, I think, no fault of his own, many of his responses had to do with very technical issues of halacha, such as writing gittin or aguna issues. So I'll talk about the right way to write various names in a get, which has very important halachic content, but doesn't help me very much in my ability to present it in ways that I think could be interesting. So this responsum touches on issues that I think are broader than that and come up with it's an aguna question, really, but touch on really broader issues that I thought would be interesting for us to learn. And then I found a response of Rav Moshe Feinstein, because you can always find the response of Rav Moshe Feinstein for the 9th of the Iyar that raises not exactly the same issues, but issues about how we do or don't deal with Jews who are not keeping the Torah properly. So the example in Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's case was a tshuva written on the 23rd of Elul. The question was the 23rd of Elul of Tufshin Yudalin of 1954. I'm sorry. Let me backtrack. The response was 23rd of Elul of Tufshin Yudalin, which would have been 1953. And the reason why I got to cheat and put this in here, and again, I recognize that I'm cheating, but I wanted to get a chance to learn from Tzvi Pesach Frank, and I feel like I've ignored him so many times. And the answer is because later on, we'll see that there's a note appended to it from about 3 years later, a little over 3 years later, the 9th of Iyar of Tufshin Yud Zayin of 1957. So we'll get to it. So the question was, a Rev in Buenos Aires, Argentina, writes to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Now, I don't know how the communication went at that time, but this is 1953, so it might have been that they sent the telegram, and he sent the first answer, the basic answer by telegram, or maybe they had a transatlantic phone call, or, meaning if they sent it by the mail, it was weeks each way that it went. In any case, in Buenos Aires, a man in Buenos Aires comes to this rabbi in Buenos Aires and says that his daughter had gotten married a little while before in a reform wedding. So this is already just an example of what Rabbanim have to put up with. Meaning the father is coming to this man, to this rabbi in Buenos Aires, coming to this rabbi in Buenos Aires saying, listen, my daughter got married, we had a reform rabbi do the ceremony. So you think he'd say, oh, it was terrible. He's just, this is what we did. Reform rabbi did the ceremony. And then a little while after the ceremony was done, after they got married, she found out that this husband of hers had converted to Christianity 2 years before the wedding. So that led to a fight. She thought he was Jewish. Now, clearly they're not that Jewish, because she would have noticed it otherwise, and he's probably not that Christian either. But he had converted to Christianity. They got into a fight. The fight escalated until he left the house, and then he disappeared. He left the house and disappeared. So what's the problem? She now seems to be married to this man, and he's not around to give her a get, or even for us to know if he died, so maybe she'd be freed of the wedding, of the marriage, because of that. Father's now coming to the rabbi, desperate, right? Why is he desperate? Because he wants to find a way to save the daughter from her situation, and the father is so worried, is also worried that if we tell her she can't get married to me, she's stuck, that she will, now he says, shelo tetzei chas v'shalom l'tarbut ra'ah. She will not, I'm not sure what he means by tarbut ra. She'll go, I mean, tarbut ra means she'll go to a bad end, she'll go to a bad culture, she'll go, you know, usually it would mean she'll abandon Judaism. But I'm not sure what it means that she'll abandon Judaism, since she seems to have already largely abandoned Judaism. She got married by a reform rabbi. She married a man who, whether or not she knew it at the time, was certainly not acting Jewishly enough that his having converted to Christianity was an issue for him. So I don't know. I don't know what he means by that. But that's the way people work, right? The father thinks she'll leave the religion even more. Maybe she's threatening to marry a non-Jew consciously this time. She's not a Christian. It's not clear on the tshuva. But the father's very upset. The father's very worried. So the rabbi who's writing to or discussing this with Yitzchak Frank, the rabbi from Buenos Aires, says, you know, as a reform rabbi who did the wedding, if that's true, it's likely that the witnesses to the wedding were mechalalei Shabbat, were people who violate Shabbat in public. So we generally assume the people who violate Shabbat in public are not able to serve as valid halakhic witnesses. And then the second claim, and he says this is the even more important claim, is that had the girl known, had the young woman known, that this man had converted to another religion, to Christianity, she never would have gotten married to him for all the money in the world, and therefore shouldn't it count as what's called Kiddushei Taut. Kiddushei Taut in more recent years, become somewhat more controversial, because when there are divorce problems in the world where both parties are present, there are rabbis out there who would say, well, let's just call it a Kiddush HaTorah. Let's find a way to say this Kiddush HaTorah, and then we can get out of the marriage more easily. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't such a thing as Kiddush HaTorah. There is such a thing as Kiddush HaTorah where either spouse has so misled the other that it doesn't count as a marriage because it was conducted under fraudulent conditions. So there is such a concept in halacha. If that were true in halacha, then we would say the marriage never occurred halachically, and it was fraudulent to begin with, and therefore she could get married to whoever she wanted because she was never married to this man. So that would be like even better claim. One possible claim is to say it's not a valid marriage because there were no valid witnesses, and in halacha, if there aren't valid witnesses to the wedding ceremony, then it's not a ceremony, it's not a valid marriage, even if both parties to the marriage agree that they got married. Meaning, let's say a man and a woman come to us, they're so thrilled, so excited, and they say, you know, we were alone in a movie theater last night or whatever. We were walking in the park last night, and he gave me a ring, and he put on the ring on my finger, and he said, Harei mekudeshet li, you are betrothed to me, kedam moshev Yisrael, and we're married. So the answer is, halachically, they're not married, because unless you have witnesses to the marriage ceremony, it's called Edut L'Kiyum HaDavar, you need witnesses to establish it, not witnesses to verify it for us, meaning even if we know that it happened, we need to have witnesses part of the ceremony. So if the witnesses weren't valid halachic witnesses, then the ceremony didn't take place either. That's the question. Rashi Ben Safran is mostly going to focus on that second question, though, on whether or not we can call it a Kiddush HaTorah. He points out that the Gemara and Bava Kama and Kuf Yud Amid Bet 110b, says, let's say you have a Yivamah. So remember, a Yivamah is a woman whose husband passed away without children. By Torah law, she should be marrying the brother of the deceased, although there is the possibility of what's called Kalitza, the possibility of performing a ceremony that will allow her not create a Yibam marriage, but to go off and marry somebody else. So the Gemara says that if she fell before a Mukashkin, let's say the brother, the only surviving brother, is a Mukashkin, which is somebody who has a significant bodily disease. It might be contagious if they have physical contact, but it's more of a skin disease that makes it disgusting to look at the person, makes it very difficult to be in his company. So the Gemara in Bava Kama says that she doesn't need a chalitza. Now, it suggests maybe she doesn't need a chalitza, because maybe she didn't ever intend to commit to being willing to be married to this man because he's got such physical deformities and problems. That's what the Gemara asks as a question, and then it says, no, not true. De'isha b'chol dehu nechala. So, b'chol dehu nechala is an assumption of the Gemara. There have been those who have claimed that in our times this assumption should be changed. There was a famous story of Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zechus HaLivracha, arguing vigorously that these kinds of assumptions by the Gemara are meant to be universal and objective and timeless and not a function of social things. That when we say Isha b'chol dehu nechala, that the Chazal were making a statement about the inherent psychology of women. That's an interesting claim to think about, but it's not our issue particularly. It's not going to come up here. But it would be an interesting question. If you had somebody who today had some kind of a serious skin illness where people, by and large, almost all people are not willing to marry such a person. It's very difficult for them to get married. They mostly don't get married. Were there to be such a thing? And the Yabam, and we, let's say we did Yibam today as well, would we still today apply the assumption that when a woman gets married, she is understanding and accepting the possibility that she'll need Yibam with that brother-in-law? Today, I think that you could say she's not even assuming she'll need Yibam with the brother-in-law, even if he was a perfectly healthy specimen and the best-looking guy in the world, because at least Ashkenazi Jews don't perform Yibam. Ravan Yosef assumes it's right, and she'll do. We'll get to that another day. But so that's a whole set of questions that we won't get into now because they don't come up here. Because, well, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank notes that this Gemara does seem to imply that when it comes to Yibum, a woman will accept anything, then you could say, here too, why don't we assume that Isha Bechol Dehu Nechala, that a woman is willing to accept anything to get married, and as long as she accepted it. Now, you could argue that there she knew he was a Mukashkin, although maybe he became a Mukashkin after the marriage, but anyway, we're not going to have to get into that because he's going to point out to us that the Mordechai Yivamot says, well, that might be true in the Gemara for a physical illness, like being a Mukashkin, like having serious bodily problems and physical deformities and skin lesions or whatever. It's not true, the Mordechai suggests, if the brother-in-law, who now the surviving brother, is a Mumar. The surviving brother is somebody who has left Judaism. So the Mordechai reports that there are those Geonim who held that you allow the Yivama, this widow, to marry another Jew without a chalitza either. Now the reason why you want to do that is because in those times, if a man was a mumar, if a man had left Judaism, and you came to him and said, listen, your sister-in-law, who the widow of your brother who's passed away, needs a chalitza from you, they would say no. It's a reminder also to me, every time I see this halakha and think about it, is that already in the time of the Gaonim live are pre the year 1000. I keep wanting to talk about the non-Jewish calendar, but, you know, the first millennium, but it's the first millennium in an account that we don't really count. But in the time of the Gaonim, which is certainly, let's say, before the 5th LF, before the 5000, but even before that, it's like 250 years before that as well, they already had enough cases of mumarim, of people who had converted out, that this question arose. So the Mordechai reports, some Gaonim were willing to allow the widow to remarry somebody else without a chalitza. And the Maharam said, the Maharam, who's living in the late 1200s in Ashkenaz, said that this Gemara in Bava Kamma that the Rav Zipa Tzfrank just quoted about the Mukkah Shechina, the man with the physical problems, actually supports the idea that a mumar, that if the surviving brother has left Judaism, that the widow does not need a chalitza, because he says, Anan sahade de mumar lo nechala. Because we all know that she would never have intended to be willing to marry a mumar. Meaning, Maharam Rimberg is saying, maybe the Gemara is able to say that women would be willing to accept the possibility of having to marry a mukashchin in order to get married. Marrying with physical issues, because physical issues are, you deal with physical issues, you struggle with them. But to marry a mumar, marrying somebody who's left the religion, that nobody would accept. Now, I want to just point out that that's a pretty slippery slope, because as soon as you say that we are allowed to add in anansades of our own, so that gets to all sorts of questions. So if you said to me, well, today, X physical blemish is so significant that nobody gets married to people like that, then would that Gemara still, would we be able to say that the woman doesn't have to worry about chalitza with that kind of a yabam as well? That's an interesting open question, but not our question for right now. So the Rav Zipa Frank says, therefore you can say if the yabam is a mumar at sh'at kiddushin, when the marriage occurred, then there was no mekachtos, there's no fraud here, because she knew that her brother-in-law had left the religion, and then the problem arose later, you would say, because she only needed to get married to him later, and yet she's Ptura. So here, Kal v'chomer says, all the more so in our case, the problem existed at the time of the Kiddushin. She had known about it, and therefore it's more likely to say it's fraudulent, more likely to say the Kiddushin never occurred, and therefore she doesn't have to worry about it. Then, of course, there is the idea that it was a Reformed rabbi, so therefore, almost definitely, the witnesses were not valid witnesses. There's also, he points out, a tshuva in Mahari Mintz, who says that there's a debate among the authorities as to whether if a lapsed Jew, a mumar, a Jew is converted, either who has just abandoned observance or is converted to another religion, let's say he tries to marry a Jewish woman with the Jewish wedding ceremony. So the Mahari Mintz reports that there's a debate among the authorities whether that works d'oraita. Is that still marriage? Or is it only a marriage at a rabbinic level? Meaning, Chazal, the rabbis, wanted marriage like that to have some effect because they didn't want Jews to see people having this ceremony. And then some people have that ceremony married, some were not married. So they said all of them were married. But that really, at a biblical level, a lapsed Jew has lapsed enough, has left enough, that he, in fact, no longer, or for as long as he's left the religion, cannot create a biblical marriage with a Jewish woman. So that would be a third suffix. That would be a third doubt, at least in terms of the biblical issues about the Torah law of marriage. And therefore, if you have a problem with Igun Godol, you have a problem, she's going to be stuck and she's not going to be able to get married to anybody else, Rav Zvi Pesach Frank thinks that you can rule to allow her to get married to somebody else, even without having to get a divorce from this convert to Christianity. Then the editors of Rav Zvi Pesach Frank's volume write, Od b'inyan zeh nimtza b'kaveh Rabbeinu. We found another note about this issue in the writings of Rav Zvi Pesach Frank. And here's the note, and this is the one that allowed us to put it into this day's response of the day. Hayom Erev Shabbat Kodesh Tet Iyar Tufshin Yudzayin. Today, the 9th of Iyar of 1957, Rav Zvi Pesach Frank writes, Ra'iti b'tshuvat chesed le'Avraham, Tinyan, whatever he found the book of responsa, who had written, you added another point. All those Gemaras that we're talking about are where the problematic person is the Yabam, is the brother, the surviving brother. But the surviving brother is only an issue for her if her husband passes away without children. But you can easily imagine that when a woman is getting married, and as she's getting married, she assumes and hopes that the marriage is going to be a successful, fruitful, and long-lasting marriage. She's hoping her husband will live. She's hoping her husband will have children with her, right? Because she wants children. So there's where you argue that if, sadly, the divine will took it another way, such that the man passed away without children. So there you say, well, she was willing to get married to the first guy, and she was willing to take the risk of needing Yibum from this, Mukashchin. Right? Maybe that's where the Gemara says, Nechala, that the value of getting married is worth the risk of possibly in the future needing a Yibum or a Chalitza from this brother. But, says the Chesed Avram, that's not true for where she's going to have to live with the actual, meaning if nobody, there is no Gemara that says if a woman marries a man and he's hidden from her that he's a mukashchin, that he's got these physical problems, that she's nonetheless forced to be married to him because isha b'chol donichol. That's not what the Gemara says. The Gemara says only that if it was the brother-in-law, because they're, that's what the Chesed Avram argues, that the Gemara only meant when it applied this principle of Isha Becholdehu Nechala, that a woman is willing to accept anything to get married, it only meant where there's a risk of anything, not that it meant actual anything. So actual anything is much different there. We have no reason to think that she intended to get married when it was hidden from her that these are the situations that go on. Now, he also smoothed out a wrinkle that you might have had. There's a Tosfot in Ketubot that says that we don't usually say that something is a Kideshi Tot or things like that, based on an umdana, based on our assumptions about what she did, would or wouldn't have been willing to accept, there's somebody else involved. Meaning if a transaction occurs between two people, and one person says, oh, I never meant that, but then another person involved in the transaction, so there we often do not, Tosfot held, we don't allow ourselves to nullify it, because we say, well, you can't nullify that other person's intentions, and they meant to have something occur. But since in our case, the other person, the intention of the other person, who's the husband, is irrelevant to us because he doesn't care about being married because he doesn't care about Judaism. So he doesn't care about being married in a Jewish way. So if I told him the Jewish marriage is going to go away, what if he said, I do care? The point is, it doesn't matter if he does. We don't care if he cares because since he's not, in fact, involved in the Jewish religion, he's not a member of the Jewish religion, meaning in his mind, not a member of the Jewish religion anymore, then the idea that you tell him, halakhically, this is going to be or not going to be a marriage, doesn't matter. So his opinion is not important to us, and therefore, we should be able to nullify the marriage and say it was a kiddush etaut, she was misled, and she never committed to the marriage, and she can go and marry somebody else. And then he quotes, there's a book called Chaim Shel Shalom, who said also, if she found out that he was a mumar, so Rav Yitzchak is going to say, I don't know what he means by found out. If she found out at the time of the kiddush, at the time of the wedding, Chaim Shel Shalom thinks that if it was known that he was a mumar, then he also thinks it's a medical cause. So that supports the idea. Then Rav Yitzchak Frank has this odd line at the end that he leaves the Tzariq Iyun as he's not sure what the answer is. He says, I wonder whether you can distinguish between when he's a mumar at the time of the wedding or he became a mumar after the wedding. Because he says, after the wedding, shat nisuin loya mekach tos. There wasn't anything fraudulent at the time of the wedding. I think he's implying, which would be a very far-reaching thing, and he doesn't rule this way, so we can't rely on it, but I think he's suggesting that if the husband later becomes a mumar, then maybe she never intended to accept that, and therefore, in some retroactive way, the marriage might be batel, which would be very, very, it's hard for me to even say that's what he meant, but that's what seems to be the question that he raises, because, and then that would be a question of also our umdana, our understanding of what she meant to accept. So a lot of this becomes a question of what do we think women, women are or are not willing to accept in marriages. In our particular case, we don't have to go that far, because it's clear to everybody, even though she's not observant, or not particularly observant, it's clear to everybody that if he was a convert to another religion at the time of the marriage, and she hid that from her, then there's no reason to think that she meant to accept the marriage, therefore it's not at all a marriage, and therefore she can marry somebody else and does not have to worry about getting divorced from this man. So that's Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank for the 9th of Iyar. Somewhat similar, and not a completely similar issue, but an issue of how we think about or deal with those who are not as observant as we would like them to be. So in Shut Igret Moshe, in the Choshen Mishpat section, Bet Mem Tet, the second time he did Choshen Mishpat in Igret Moshe, Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked by a man about, a man didn't have children, and he wants to write a will, and he wants to know how he should divide up the possessions among the members of the family. He's got relatives, but they're not children, and he also wants to give to Torah institutions. He wants to leave, you know, charitable bequest, and what should he do? So this is from the 9th of Iyar of 1979, a Tufshin Lamed Tet. So Moshe Feinstein says, if you don't have children, now the next response, which I'm not sure we'll get to, if we do, we'll do it very quickly, and it's not dated to 9 Iyar, but the next response in the book is about when you do have children and what you can or cannot do, or what you're supposed to or not supposed to do in terms of giving money to other people than the children. But when you don't have children, so Moshe Feinstein says you have more of a choice. And therefore, there, in that situation, he thinks that it's clear that you're allowed to favor those relatives who are Torah observant, especially those relatives who learn in kolo, as it were, whose Torah tan umenotam, will spend their time in the study of Torah, and also to give preference to those relatives who were, to this man who's writing the will, had raised some of his, you know, nephews or cousins, not clear who they are, but those you raised in your own home, he says, have probably more of a claim on your support and your will than other people. But that's only, and now he gives some standards to think about, that's only if their needs are exactly the same, which is never true. So Moshe Feinstein gives us some ways to think about these questions. It depends on family size of the whoever you're thinking about giving to, right? If you have one with a larger family and one with a smaller family, so you might be give to the larger family because it's more difficult, but you have to worry, all you have to think also about, do they have sources of support? And when you think about their sources of support, or profit, or investments, or whatever it is, you think about the quantity and the quality, if they're likely to stay, you know, it's an annuity, for example, so unless the bank goes bust, they're going to be getting this amount of money forever, or if it's more shaky, more unstable, the amount that we're talking about. So you should weigh all that into as you're thinking about apportioning it among them. And this is the impulse to give some of this money to Torah institutions is also a good idea, and therefore he thinks that you should give a third. Moshe Feinstein says, he doesn't tell you how he gets to a third, but he thinks a third can go to Torah institutions and two-thirds to the relatives, to the Torah observant relatives who are studying Torah all the time, who have the need. And he says, even if they're not poor, this is an interesting question also. When you're giving out money, should you give to the poor or should you give to the... That's a hard question. So he says, even if these relatives aren't poor in the sense that they lack for bread, they lack for clothing, but they're under financial pressure. And by bequeathing them some money, you're going to help them and let them be able to live berevach, with a certain sort of sense of comfort or of relaxation. That says lefi rucham. So lefi rucham, I think, is an interesting question, because lefi rucham means according to the standard of living that they're used to. Now, some people, I think, you could question whether, if you're thinking about giving their money in a will, you could say, well, sure, they're struggling, but they're also decided, even though he's learning, you know, full-time, to live at a standard of living that I don't think is necessarily... So Rav Moshe Feinstein just says, well, the standard of living they accept, I think he's assuming that it's a reasonable standard of living. If you're going to help them not have to give up their full-time Torah study, to help them not only if they're poor, but to help them have a little bit of comfort within their standard of living, he thinks that's what you should do. Then he points out, though, that's all... If you don't know, not only if you don't have children, but if you don't have yorshim. So yorshim, heirs in halacha, are achim, brothers, b'nei achim, or nephews, or sisters, or nieces. So Moshe Feinstein thinks all of those are part of the family. He doesn't go further than that. So he may think it's only that one generation, meaning it's certainly true if the man had grandchildren. But he seemingly never had children. So now Moshe Feinstein is saying, but beyond that, siblings... All right, now he doesn't go further than siblings and nieces and nephews, but he thinks those are relatives that are close enough that there is a concept in the Gemara called Iyabure Achsanta. So Iyabure Achsanta means that something's in a certain home and is used to being residing in a certain place, and you move it to another place. So the Gemara says, Ein Ruach Chachamim Nocha Hemenu, that Chazal made clear that they thought that's a bad idea. Now that's a very broad question, a very broad issue to think about, that Rav Moshe gets into a little bit here, but that's just to consider that the Gemara seems to be assuming that when money's in a certain family, you shouldn't just randomly rid the family of that money. So you can say, well,
it's my money to do with what I want. In some sense, that's true. But the Gemara is saying there's this concept here that we think, we, the Gemara, think you need to be aware of called Iburi Asanta, that when money has come to reside within a certain family, you know, he doesn't say it this way, so you could talk about how to express this in the proper way, but I think it's sort of like, if Hashem decided that this family should have this money, then it's not our place to decide, you know what, I think the money should go somewhere else. That we're supposed to keep the money in the family, do good things with that money, so some aspect of doing good things with that money is giving money to tzedakah, and Moshe Feinstein is not saying, so don't give to Torah institutions in your will, but he's saying, but if you're just randomly giving out money to to distant relatives who happen to be living in Kollel or whatever it is, and you have brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews on all sides, so there he thinks there is this concept of the Gemara, Iburi Achsanta, and one should be careful about not doing that. Now, the Ksos reports at Tashbitz, who seems to think that just giving even just four zuze, four amounts of gold, which was nothing, it wasn't a huge amount of money, if you give that to the relatives, that would be good enough. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, I don't understand, because it's a Gemara Ketubot and Ben-Bed, where Yehuda bar Marei Meir didn't want to join Rav Papa in giving an extremely generous nedunya to his son, even though that's, you know, that's giving money within the family, and presumably Rav Papa wasn't making himself destitute, he was leaving himself at least four zuze, and Rav Yehuda bar Meir quotes this idea of Iburi Achsanta. I think you're alienating your money in a way you're not supposed to. So that's part of what makes me think that there's an idea here that if Hashem is giving money to certain people, their job isn't to give that money away and just get rid of it. Their job is to handle that money in appropriate, responsible, and proper way. So Rav Moshe Feinstein thinks the four zuze seems very extreme to him. Now, one option could have been that at the time of the Tashbitz, four zuze was worth a lot more than we think of it as today, meaning there are numbers that you could quote from, you know, amounts of money made in the 1930s, and I told you those numbers, you'd think that's a crazy amount of money. For example, in the next Shuva, Rav Moshe Feinstein had written in 1966, not 9 years, but it's also about the same issue. He says that if you leave a significant gift to relatives, that largely alleviates the problem. He's going to say that now based on the Tashbitz right here, too. So we're still in this tshuva, but the number he names, what he says is, so the Tashbitz shows us that if you leave the Yarshim, the actual heirs, some reasonable amount, then it doesn't count as a prohibition, and therefore, if you've left to the Yarshim a certain amount. So in our tshuva that we're looking at from the 9th of Iyar of 1979, Moshe Feinstein thinks if you leave the Yorshim a fifth of the inheritance, and then with four-fifths, you're going to divide it a third of those four-fifths. The third of four-fifths is four-fifteenths of the original Yerusha will go to Torah institutions, and then two-thirds, that'd be eight-fifteenths, or just a little over half the original inheritance would go to the relatives who are learning Torah regularly. That, he thinks, is a significant enough gift. In the next responsum, which in the book, I mean, which is not related to our date, but is also about issues of this idea, the man is worried about whether or not he can give a will in which he disenfranchises some of the heirs. This man has three children. Two of them don't keep Shabbos. They violate Shabbos in public, and they don't teach their children, they don't raise their children to the Torah. And then he has a daughter who's married to a non-Jew, and there are rumors that she converted herself to the other religion, to Christianity. So before he died, he's given most of his possessions to tzedakah, and he's got one son, I'm sorry, of the two children who weren't keeping the Torah, one was a daughter who married a non-Jew. He's got one son who still keeps Torah, and he named him executor of the will, and he gave each of his children $1,000, and each of the grandchildren a certain amount of money, on the condition the grandchildren marry Jews. And the children are rich anyway, so he wants to know if that's okay. I got into this because my point was that $1,000 in 1966, depending on how you figure it out, is $7,500 today, maybe $10,000 today. It's not nothing. So that's what he means by a significant gift. But to know those numbers, you have to look. So maybe the Tashbitz, when he referred to four zehuvim, it was an amount in their economy that was a large amount, perhaps. But that's the way Moshe Feinstein understands it. So in the 9 year tshuva, he understands it as an issue of, he thinks you have to give a fifth to the Yerushim. Here, he seems more comfortable with a $1,000 number. He goes through, again, the idea of Iburi Achsanta. You have to just disenfranchise your descendants. And then he says, at the end of that tshuva, which we're not doing because it's not our day for the tshuva, but he makes a very, to me, interesting comment at the end of that tshuva, because this man, remember, has two children who are completely non-observant, not relating their children to Torah. One is intermarried. And so Moshe Feinstein says,
after this whole discussion, part of the whole discussion was that the problem with Iburi Achsanta, one of the problems with Iburi Achsanta is also that maybe they'll have the maybe the children aren't doing living life the best way, but disenfranchising or disinheriting them isn't great because they might have children or grandchildren who will be better. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says that's true about children who don't act well. They're doing the wrong thing. They violate the Torah in certain ways, but they believe in Hashem. They believe in the Torah, and they send their kids to, you know, Jewish schools, as it were. They send their kids to yeshivas. So kids like that, you're not supposed to disinherit because who knows how life turns around. They may have a change of heart. Their kids may have a change of heart, right? And therefore, you don't want to just deny them all the money and turn them and make them impoverished. But even if he himself, even the child himself, is a big chote, is a big sinner in things between, you know, man and man, in many mitzvot, in many issues of how to live with other people, but the basic faith is there, and the basic commitment to Torah and mitzvot is there, and therefore, you have to assume, or you have to think, that the possibility exists that things will go better in future generations through Torah and mitzvot. But that's not true, says Rav Moshe Feinstein. In 1966, he says, at least, now people who run NCSY and stuff like that can argue that this might not be true, and organizations like that might argue this is not true, but Rav Moshe Feinstein says, but a mumarim, people who violate Shabbos in public and violate all the Issurim of the Torah, and they don't send their kids to Jewish schools, he says, "Ein listapek bizarra me'ali." You don't even have to worry that they're going to end up having children who come back to Torah observance. And if there are, it's going to be a miut shelo matzu. It's a minority, under a small minority. Such a small minority, you don't have to account for it. Now, I will say that there became a time when important people, Rabbi Shlomo Riskin, Rabbi Ephraim Buchwald, and other people created venues in which people did come back to Torah and mitzvot. I've been told by people, a lot of people, though, that a lot of those people were people who grew up in conservative homes. The conservative Judaism was close enough still to a sense of attachment to orthodoxy, to religion, that they were, you know, ripe for or prone to understanding that they should come back to a life of Torah and mitzvot. But that once that group is gone, that really the idea that people who are not observant will come to observant is much more rare than it used to be. We come around to this idea of Moshe Feinstein's as well. So when it comes to dealing with Jews who are either completely rejecting of the religion, that was Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank's tshuva with a man who had become a mumar, who had converted to Christianity. So there you have a set of issues and rules about how to deal with such people and the extent to which we have to count them as Jews. And in that case, we don't count them enough as Jews to think that when they got married and hid that fact from the wife, that counts in any way as a marriage. And Moshe Feinstein talks about when it comes to giving out one's money in an inheritance, the extent to which we do and should take into account the religious activity of the possible heirs, if they're close relative heirs, and also of, if we don't have close relative heirs, we're going to give it to more distant relatives, of the importance and value of including in that calculus the question of their involvement in Torah and their financial needs. And that's Response of the Day for the 9th of Iyar. My name is Gideon Rothstein. Thank you to Rabbi Jacob Romitz, the OU, to David Hochhauser for making the shiurim available to you. Feel free to write me. I'd love to hear from you. My name is Gideon Rothstein. My email is grothst@gmail.com. Have a great day.